Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are, diving or ascending towards the vernal equinox when the force of nature pushes up through the frozen crust of the earth and emerges. So we are welcoming Shahid Batar, correct my pronunciation, running for California's 12th Congressional District, currently held by Nancy Pelosi. Since graduating from Stanford Law School in 2003, Shahid has worked in both San Francisco and Washington as a legal advocate, a nonprofit leader, a grassroots organizer, and a poet and musician, frequently attending Burning Man. His wide-ranging work reflects a commitment to feminism, democratic socialism, international human rights. His passions have long aligned around a common purpose, building the movement to place human rights and human needs like peace and climate justice before corporate profits. His website is shahidforchange.us. Welcome, Shahid.
Thank you so much for me, Caroline.
I do want to let the I Ching introduce you, because I did ask how best to introduce you, and it was quite specific. It responded, sprouting of the world tree, preparing the change for a new guiding figure, stripping away the old, and return of the spirit opens path. It is the dusk before dawn. It is an advantageous trial for all beings. Let all consider their role at this time. Accumulate energy for a difficult yet exciting task. Like young plants breaking through hard crust of earth, this will open an entire new cycle of time. Install helpers, delegate responsibilities, stake out territory, establish bases of operation, assemble the team. By stripping away old ideas, abundant new possibilities are being born. Weave alliances together. The ideal, realizing person sets standards that gives everyone a place in the new world. Work through rousing and inspiration. A cycle is beginning that will deliver us from past sorrows. I thought that was pretty good of the I Ching.
It gave me chills the whole time you were reading it. Frankly, I feel like I should consult the I Ching more often.
Well, our word inaugurate comes from the augur, right? It is the diviner part of all of us that would consult the I Ching, or nature, really, and nature would reveal the responsible human, and then they would be inaugurated. I mean, all our language really is, you know, magic if we go back. So how wonderful, and wherever you want to go with that, but I loved its emphasis about weaving all, and, you know, this inclusive magnetizing we're animating a desirable all-inclusive story of sane leadership at this time of extraordinary crisis, right? So I toss it to you.
Yeah, no, I feel very humbled, certainly, by the reflection, and I do feel very desperately that we need new leadership at a time like this, if only because our leaders have so dramatically failed to meet the demands of the moment. And the other part of the introduction you shared that really compelled me was this idea. There was an image of young plants breaking through and a transition into a new cycle. And I also feel very compelled by the need to shrug off the yoke of the predatory corporate rule that has delivered our species to the brink of a life-threatening climate crisis that is already killing Californians, is already killing people around the world, is already destabilizing the future, and that our current and past leaders have done nothing to address. I'm very eager to be among those young plants breaking through the soil, and I'm very eager to see that future that we can breathe into being together.
Yeah, eager and enthused, and enthused means that which makes the divine within us dance. So eager and enthused, and I will say on behalf of KPFA's nonprofit status that I have extended an invitation according to protocol and ally etiquette to Nancy Pelosi to be a guest in some future Thursday. So there we. So now off we go. We're free to romp. And I don't know if you had a chance to see the clip I'd sent you and your press team of Bernie's live address today. Did you get a chance to
I did
see
not get a chance
that,
to see the clip, unfortunately.
Well, let me just say, because, you know, this idea of leadership and let us all, as you are doing, define what is leadership now. And he was so deft. We're all in this together, solidarity, love and compassion. And then he delineated in great detail, you know, how to take care of everyone. convene bipartisan, most responsible, compassionate science, all cooperating, private and public, set up hotlines. I mean, he went on and on and on. That was thrilling. And then I just wanted to do a tip of the hat also to Katie Porter, right, who did an extraordinary job in questioning Dr. Redfield from the CDC, and she kept on him until he said, okay, you're a good questioner. Yes, free testing for everybody in America. Anyway, so I just wanted to say, we where we see good leadership, we go, yes, that's very good.
Yes.
So,
just to seize on that point, when we talk about free testing kits for everyone in America at the time of a budding pandemic, that's not rocket science. That basic common sense, I wouldn't even describe that as a feat of visionary leadership. That's just showing up for work, which is exactly what everyone in Congress hasn't done for the last 30 years. I see a cadre breaking through. They're described as the squad. I think of them as, young plants breaking through and creating a new cycle. And at every turn, whether it's human rights in crisis at the border, whether it's the human right to healthcare that corporate Democrats refuse to acknowledge, whether it's the climate crisis that they race headlong towards as if we were lemmings, in each of these contexts, I see corporate Democrats not merely failing to offer leadership, but failing basic measures of common sense. And that's just unacceptable, especially at a time like this.
Yeah, accountability and all. And I'm so glad, perusing everything I could find, and there's more. Your website is really useful and good. But also your absolute dedicated concern for the children at the border in cages, and particularly, now with a dangerous virus. And I was so grateful for that being such a dedicated part of your dynamic. And if you want to bring that up, and what we can and should do, anywhere in that realm, again, embracing that, because that is a terrible cruelty and heartbreak for all of for all sentient beings. Yeah.
Yes, and I fear that it's one that's a heartbreak that is compounding and escalating. I'm an immigrant myself, and my family came here to the States when I was 2. And the reason we immigrated was because the United States was at one point in time, for many points in time, I think until very recently, a beacon of opportunity and freedom to people around the world. And it's ironic that our criminal president wants to make America great again by sullying so many of the values that have long made our country great. For instance, I think a lot about the sacrifices of the generation that won the Second World War and the particular achievements that they secured, among them an international human rights regime, a dedication by our entire species that we would defend people around the world even from crimes by their own governments. And that's a world historical achievement. And we lost the international human rights regime, which included a international right to asylum, which we violate every day en masse at our borders. We lost those commitments not to the Nazis. We lost those commitments not to any foreign power in a war or a hacked election. We lost those rights to a bipartisan establishment in Washington, a bipartisan establishment that not only did Trump propose the concentration camps, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who represents San Francisco and Washington, she funded them. Not only did Barack Obama deport more Americans than any president in the history of our republic, but Democrats, marched to that tune and delivered the statutory powers that enabled it. Right now, President Trump has declared an ICE crackdown on sanctuary cities across the United States, including San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley. And it's unacceptable. And I frankly would like to see the federal representatives for our cities, and Nancy Pelosi hasn't said a word about it, standing up for our city's commitments to civil rights, immigrant rights, and our neighbors. That's exactly what she hasn't done either here locally in the face of Trump's crackdown by ICE or at the border in the context of the creation of these border camps. And especially with a pandemic emerging, mass detention is a recipe for not just the human rights abuse, but the contagion. I mean, it's incredibly senseless to create disease vectors that will undermine public health. And that's exactly what we've done, both by preventing people from having access to free test kits, also by, you know, herding people together in these mass detention facilities that, again, are illegal in the first place. We don't have a right to detain anyone at the border, let alone thousands of people in conditions that are inhumane. It's just, you know, compounding one human rights abuse with another.
Right. And I think that part of your team's gift, you know, is whatever we speak to in another is the part of them we're inviting to dance, you know. And it is, you know, aren't we all, isn't there some part of all of us that is outraged at churlish cruelty, you know, and the concentration camps as well. And then also just the perversity, the more than ironic perversity everywhere that food stamps are about to be constrained in the early part of April, just when people at, you know, highest risk are going to need it. Yeah, so this whole realm. I mean, do you view yourself also as, you know, and the purpose of government? Let's put everything on the table. You know, is a solicitous concern, is a safety net embrace for all beings, right? For you know, protection of life. I once got a Trump supporter, because it's useful to cross borders, and it was polarity at first. We want to spiral out of polarity, and then I said, "Well, what is your definition of wise governance?" And he's like, "Oh, I don't know." Let's start off together. The purpose of government is to protect, and he chimed in, the Commonwealth. The purpose, and it's inside us, and he was surprised that he said that too. And I go, we're in agreement. I'm going to go away now because we just achieved this moment of agreement. But is that a, you know, the purpose of government? How do you define the purpose of government and wise governance? Let's just everybody wants to answer these things.
That's a great question. I would start, you know, in the traditional conception in the United States, the purpose of government is to ensure process and ensure basic rights. So the process is the majoritarian side of the process. That's like Congress, and the courts, the anti-majoritarian parts, that's the rights. And I see beyond that sort of traditional view. I see government as the opportunity for us to come together to meet our shared needs and achieve shared accomplishments. And our greatest accomplishments have always come together. It wasn't a corporation that put a human being on the moon. It wasn't a corporation that invented the internet. You know, those were government initiatives. And I see in those spectacular examples the kind of achievements and successes we can secure together. Like, I would like to ensure ultimately, and I think we can do this, particularly because the United States is the principal enemy to it, or at least long has been, world peace is within our grasp. If we can just dismantle the Pentagon and our own military industrial complex, that will go a long way toward building global peace and justice. Climate sanity. In the face of the mounting climate chaos is, you know, at this point, it might be too far gone to recover any semblance of whatever normal used to be, but we can at least ameliorate the impacts that will otherwise grow increasingly severe over time. And those are decisions that, again, the current generation of policymakers is not chosen to do. But my vision of what government is there for is ultimately to, I wouldn't say protect the Commonwealth, but certainly to protect we the people of the United States and to give us opportunities to control our shared future. You know, we come together in the consent of the governed. We formed our constitutional republic. This vision of popular sovereignty that animates it is one to me that's really crucial, because it suggests not only that government is accountable ultimately to we the people of the United States, but that principle of popular sovereignty, it has a corollary, which is to say when our government ceases to represent us, it's important that we declare our sovereignty. I think of that as what social movements do. You know, when the Occupy movement was occupying urban centers around the United States, that was us declaring our sovereignty. In running Bernie Sanders for the White House is an opportunity for us to declare our sovereignty. We need not accept the continued predatory rule of corporations that the Democrats and the Republicans both have agreed upon. We can do better than that. And that's part of my vision of what government is for, you know, to guard the future ultimately from the predation right of the past.
Yeah, and then we'll get to what we all want to, and what is, you know, what are the qualities of leadership, you know, and just before I toss it back to you, the reason on that Commonwealth is it doesn't mean money. It means our air, our water, our the things that we, you know, our entire home is included in part of that, which you do in your dedication. And also, so glad always to hear the word sovereignty. It resonates way back in our mythic, in the very heart of the Grail legend, which is, all the myths are pertinent, because remember, Percival can only attain the Grail when he finds his secret half-black Islamic twin brother, right? And it was like, oh, that's good. And at the heart of the Grail legend, I won't go into it, but is the crucial thing of, what does nature most want? What do women most want? What does everything most want? Sovereignty. Anyway, so I just wanted to honor the resonance of your word, and then let us define what are the qualities of wise leadership.
Well, one would be a willingness to examine the facts and pay attention to them, exactly what our criminal president so frequently refuses to do. I think another one is a willingness to look beyond the current time slice to consider the future. And I see this really as a aspect of indigenous wisdom that I find very inspiring, this suggestion that we should look at the decisions that we have before us, not through the lens of what will serve us best, or, what will, to pervert it even more, what will serve some corporate pool of abstract resources best, but rather, think about what will serve future generations best. And I think wise leadership would particularly recognize that each of us are here only for moments in time, and that our fidelity ultimately has to be to something bigger than us, and at least bigger than our bank accounts or our corporate donors. And I'm committed to the future generations that don't have a chance to raise their voices today. It's frankly one of the reasons I'm running for this seat. It's obviously a pretty demanding endeavor to run against the most powerful corporate politician on the planet, especially as an immigrant, whose family lost our house when I was 16. I don't have any property. I'm not a wealthy person. I've just been fighting for our rights for 20 years, and I've watched Nancy Pelosi in too many of those struggles side with the past instead of the future, and side with corporations instead of our communities. And I do think that the impulse to get into a race that might seem so lopsided is precisely because the future is at such profound risk. And unfortunately, corporate Democrats have frankly offered nothing to protect it.
Right. And also, I don't know if you know a really great strategy book, Finite and Infinite Games, by James Carson, which he says, a finite game's about winning, blah, 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 blah. Infinite game's about keeping everything in play. So there's a winning to a campaign, of course, which is important, but also just the introduction and liberating of public conversation about these things that are so dear to your and our hearts. And I love that in your bio, well, you're the youngest of four, right? And in the fairy tale, it's the youngest who pulls the thing off, right? Just it's a heroic posture, because you are the youngest of four, right?
I am, yeah.
That's really great. And that you've been for a long time cross-pollinating Washington, D.C. and California, which this show for 23 years has been going, they need each other symbolically and literally. And thank you for serving time in Washington already. And, I pulled up your D.C. guerrilla poetry insurgency thing, and you say, I'm a creative countercultural change agent. And I go, excellent. All right, let's play with that. Because you are a poet, and you have been to Burning Man, and there is say more about that. And you do art things, and you've created parties that people can go to in San Francisco. Do you want to open this part up, the cultural part of that politics and culture no longer be separated? They want to be intertwined.
Absolutely. Well, they are inextricably. I say that the gains of prior generations, when people think of eras in the past, when we had movements for social justice that became transcendent and influential, there's music was always a part of it. Folk music was a part of the movement of the 60s. People credit rock and roll music with being a tremendous force in bringing democracy to the countries of the former Warsaw Pact. The very earliest, I think, forms of expression were music and creative expression, probably to connect with each other about whatever was at hand. My earliest, some of the work I've been proudest about, frankly, in politics was community organizing. In 2002 to 2003, I organized three different collectives of performing artists, one in Palo Alto, the Stanford Spoken Word Collective. Then in the summer of 2003, here in San Francisco, I was one of four poets who started a weekly poetry convergence at the corner of 16th and Mission. And that's happened every Thursday night for the last 17 years. And then I went to Washington that fall. It was the first of two stints I've had in our nation's capital. And when I got there the first time, I founded the DC Guerrilla Poetry Insurgency. Each of those groups is still active today. And each of them has trained hundreds together. They've probably trained, you know, at least 1,000 poets. And these are visionary, and some comedians and hip hop MCs, you know, some singers, but people who are using their own creative impulses to breathe into being the brighter future and their own vision of it that we all share. I think there's a particular point to make here about the DC Guerrilla Poetry Insurgency. So when I went to Washington the first time, it was the fall of 2003. I'd just been to Burning Man for the first time. I'd graduated from law school that spring. And by my third year at Stanford, well, let me set that up. I got there, I got my undergrad degree working and going to school at night for the better part of a decade. And I wrote a thesis about how to achieve radical wealth redistribution through a market economy. And that was at least some of what got me into Stanford. That was the basis for my first academic law review article. By the time I'd finished school, I was teaching constitutional law and basically full-time organizing to try to stop the war. And I was part of the movement of 20,000 residents from across the Bay Area who laid siege to San Francisco's financial district nonviolently for the day and a half after Bush invaded Iraq. I was proud to have brought about 500 students up from Stanford. We've been organizing for months by that point. We down in the South Bay locked down at a Lockheed Martin facility that spring. And that spring and summer to me were very inspiring in terms of, and this connects with the question you're raising around the relationship between culture and art and politics, that period demonstrated to me what popular sovereignty and what people power means. And it means, among other things, people coming together, sharing convictions, sharing resources, sharing ideas and plans, and organizing to execute projects together. And in that is a remarkable synthesis. And it's more powerful than any policy. It's more powerful than any resource. Like, communities coming together in pursuit of a shared vision is... It's amazing, and having encountered people power and having had a chance to see it, and then again to see it again later in the Occupy movement, in the movement for Black Lives, in the immigrant rights movement, in the each of the social movements that I've had a chance to be a part of. You know, one of the first things I did when I went to Washington the first time was bring the movement for marriage equality to the East Coast, and I was fighting in the courts as a cis hetero Muslim lawyer raised in the Midwest. For the equal rights of my LGBTQ neighbors. And this was 10 years before Nancy Pelosi would even accept their rights, let alone do anything to fight for them. And frankly, she never lifted a finger in the marriage equality struggle ever. You know, she basically came to accept equality on the eve of a decision by a conservative Supreme Court. And, you know, you asked before about the characteristics of wise leadership, I think at least wise representatives are ones who fight for our communities and our rights instead of being dragged to embrace those rights years after the fact. I'm very eager to defend the rights of all of my neighbors and all people. I think that's the charge before not just politicians, but also creative visionaries and artists of all kinds. You know, we're here to speak the truth and to make it compelling. And I'm eager to do each of those things. And at the end of the day, I think of the helix that art, culture, politics, and reality represent. And you know, I've been grateful for the chance to work across each of those arenas. And I am eager to try to bring them together to the extent I can.
So what do you have imminent that would be a participatory musical rallying event? Do you have anything on? Well, actually, it's difficult now. Nobody's gathering, right? Maybe you don't have anything.
Gatherings are a little bit suspended on account of the outbreak. I do have every month I DJ a set at Lookout. It's a club in the Castro, on Market and Noe and 16th. Most of my music in the past has been shared in festival settings. This isn't coming up, but, you know, a highlight, at least from the past, one of my favorite sets I had a chance to play was at the Catharsis Festival across the street from Trump's White House in November 2017. And yeah, I led that set off with a Malcolm X quote, and it was revolution for the 2 hours I had the decks. And, you know, I saw in Washington, each of the times that I've lived there, as well as the times that I've gone back to perform and speak, a hunger, not just from California, but around the country, of people that are done with corporate rule, people who want to make sure that human needs are treated like human rights, people who are aghast at the moral travesty of homelessness, people who are absolutely appalled that we continue going to war, people who are frustrated that so many of our resources get sucked into the gaping maw of a human rights abusing military industrial complex, and people who just want to have a viable future for all of us and our kids. And I see when the politics isn't expansive enough to give us an opportunity to promote those ideas, for me, the culture and the art was. You know, I used art and culture before I was able to use politics to advance the same vision. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm running for Congress is because I saw Bernie in 2016 run for the presidency on a platform that basically aligned with the creative vision that I as an artist had been espousing my whole life, and that I as a direct action activist and as a community organizer and as an impact litigator and as a leader of nonprofits. You know, he articulated a vision that resonated very deeply with me, and apparently, turns out, with millions of Americans. And he is far and away the most popular politician in the country. He's the most trusted politician in the country. He has more support than any politician in the country. And an entire political party that is not in power is trying to put him in a bottle so they can advance a careerist to confront a tyrant. And, you know, anybody who lived through 2016 knows how that ends. And I do think of the art. The reason for me that the art is so powerful as it relates to politics is that the art unlocks the opportunity for the politics to be about truth and principle instead of just about power and performance. And I'm coming to the politics as an artist committed to truth, committed to human rights, and committed to defending the future.
Great. Art unlocks. Yes, we're all up everything, you know, for liberating. May it be liberating. And right before our very short break, you will be with us through the rest of the hour. But can you explain to our listening, dynamic listening audience, you know, how you came to be able to run against Nancy Pelosi this November because of the primary rules being changed? Because you came in second, right?
Right. Yeah, several cycles ago in the early 2010s, the state legislature shifted the process for congressional elections in the state of California. A lot of people think about primary elections as each political party having its own separate process, the winners of which go on to face each other in the general election. And because so much of California is effectively one-party regions, you know, we have sort of all Democrats up north and parts of Southern California are very solidly Republican. In order to ensure that general elections were competitive, the state legislature shifted the rules so that in our primaries, all the parties and their respective candidates, they all run against each other. And the top two vote getters from the primary, which just happened a week ago, they each did the top two vote getters, regardless of their party affiliation, they each proceed to the general election. So even though I took second place in the jungle primary as the second place finisher to Nancy Pelosi, I have the opportunity to be her only general election challenger. And I do, I'm very grateful for that opportunity. I'm the first Democratic candidate to face her in a general election in the 30 years that she's been in Congress. And I'm very eager to be the last to make sure that it's the end of her term.
Right. No, that's again, as the myths tell us, you know, and even Inanna, anybody unchallenged will become tyrannical. Anybody. So it is a service to all beings. Our guest today is Shahid Buttar. Is that the right pronunciation of your last name?
You got it. Shahid Buttar. Thanks.
Shahid Buttar. He will be with us after the break. He is running for California's 12th Congressional District, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
shook the constellations and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
The Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. We are hosting Shahid Buttar, who is running for California's 12th Congressional District, and blending, again, art and music and culture with politics as they want to be together. That's great. So, you know, and I love, yes, what you're saying, art, culture, politics. If we look up the word culture in a good etymological dictionary, you know, it's all biological, and then weighed, you know, what we plant, and then weighed on the list is human culture by analogy, and I want to toss to your journey and your heritage, because there's a, I guess it was Sir Matthew Arnold, he said, to be cultured is to be acquainted with the highest possibilities of the human spirit throughout time. As well as the kind of right. So you've had journey, born in London, right, to immigrant parents. You said you came to this country when you were three, and right. Just guide us through your realm of cultivation, music, hip hop, advocacy.
Sure. Well, so I was two when my parents came to rural Missouri, and I grew up in small town America. There were under 400 people in the town I grew up in. It's called Rosebud, Missouri. There's not a stoplight in the town. The elementary school was 7 miles in one direction, and the high school was 11 miles in the other. We moved to the suburbs of St. Louis when I was 10, and that's when I started to get exposed to things, including music, including politics. Before that, when we were growing up in the country, my earliest political memories were learning about the Native American genocide. And understanding that the place, literally the land on which I was standing, had been occupied by other people before. And just as a young person who myself had immigrated, wondering what had happened to the people that were in the place that we'd come to, and understanding that the people who were there also were not from there. I'll share this. This is an anecdote I don't think I've shared publicly, but it speaks to that era in my life. I remember I skipped most of the first grade, but around then, it might have been in the first or maybe the second grade, there was a young man by the name of Jacob, a classmate of mine, and I remember him saying, he was speaking about his parents, reflecting on my family. We were the only brown family in town. You know, the whole town were the Waymires and the Pullmans, and they generally embraced us very warmly. There were attitudes that were different, and I just remember this young man reminding me or sharing that his mother had thought that I was brown because I was dirty and needed to take a bath, and my earliest memory at the time around politics was, wow, your mom must be really dumb. And it gave me a useful lens later. You know, people often mistake prejudice and racism, and you know, they don't understand the difference between them, and prejudice is an individual feeling. You know, Jacob's mom was prejudiced about me and my family, but I can't say she was racist, because racism requires power, and racism usually requires institutions like a penal system that incarcerates millions of people. You know, racism is an institutional phenomenon, and it requires power, and I encountered, when I was a young person, powerless prejudice. And I think that was one of the things that inflected my perspective as I grew up. My family lost our house when I was 16. It was right as I was finishing high school. And I started college. I just turned 17. I was at the University of Chicago, and I was on the street within a year. My family didn't have, you know, really a dime to contribute to my education, despite, you know, we thought we would when I was applying, and then things had shifted. And I'd maxed out all the federal aid available to me, and wasn't able to finished college that time around. It took me a couple years to get on my feet. I ended up getting a job And I worked for 6 years in three different investment banks, of all things. And so I had a chance in Chicago in the 90s, without an undergrad degree, to work for three different investment banks and have an early exposure basically to the precursors of the 2008 financial crisis. And it was that era of my career that particularly locked in for me my concerns about corporate rule and the need for corporate accountability. When I started law school at Stanford, the first set of subjects I chose to dive into particularly was antitrust law. And my vision for my future at the time was to work for the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission and bust big businesses and hold business accountable. The Justice Department offered me a position my first summer in school to work in the antitrust division. And I learned at the time that the Bush administration had basically shut it down. And it's frankly never been open for business since. And I see the abdication of federal enforcement of antitrust laws as at least one of the big reasons why, for instance, the internet has been subject to such dramatic corporate consolidation, and also, you know, some of the reasons why people writ large are struggling under the burden of upward redistribution to the 0.1%. Just to fill that in, for one crucial point for me of acculturation, I kind of skipped over it, but it was that period in Chicago when I wasn't going to school, when I was struggling with keeping my feet under me. That was the era when I got into poetry, basically, and it was the open mic spoken word poetry scene in Chicago that originally radicalized me and gave me an opportunity to understand what my neighbors encounter and experience. And I think it's really hard, if you open your ears to your neighbors, to come away with a deaf ear and a you know, to turn a blind eye to their struggles. And, you know, as an empathetic person, to connect with and hear directly from people of various communities about the challenges that they and their families, you know, dealt with, everything from racist police to, you know, landlords, people growing sick and not having the resources to care for each other. Like, these are the kinds of themes that are very timeless, unfortunately widely shared, because the people we are replacing in Congress have done such a bad job of providing for human needs. And that era of being cultivated as an artist, listening to other artists, forming my worldview, that was a very politically radicalizing time. And also, you know, it's hard to peel out from that the experience of not being able to go to college, despite, you know, having gotten into a strong school and having done well in school, but not being able to go to school because I didn't have the resources. And then in my business career, I was basically training sons and daughters of clients to do jobs that they typically weren't qualified for, and, you know, to watch people who often were less talented but had more polished pedigrees gain opportunities. That was just, you know, added to the sense of radicalization and frustration and the need for us to secure a different paradigm that actually puts human needs before corporate profit.
Right. And St. Louis, what a great place to become nourished by the musical traditions there. Blah, 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 blah. And then I love etymology. It's like we track everything back to its originating liberating impulse before it got bamboozled. And so the word privilege, of course, means private law. It's sort of like, well, there we have it, right? Again, if we just so the poetry in service, and it is such a time, I think, you know, for all of us, like, who brought what to this Renaissance and to practice everything we've ever held to be useful. And so in the poetry, music, political realm, do you have time to compose now? Is this part of how you might want to invite people to gather to, like, to use everything that you've gleaned in your long journey?
A little bit. I do spend some time writing, but a lot less, frankly, than I wish. Are you asking me to share the latest thing I wrote? I'm not sure if I'm.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, that'd be fun. Yeah.
All right. Sure. Let's try that. So I wrote this on a camping trip. It was several months ago now. It's the last piece I committed to memory. Shut me up if this gets uninteresting. Three generations ago, a war consumed the whole world. And what for? Millions were slaughtered from Tokyo to Warsaw, but that was not the worst that our species saw. The world's worst criminals, they built an agency an engine for crimes against humanity, invasions, assassinations, coups d'etat at independent foreign nations paved the way to human rights violations, murdering priests, raping nuns, mining harbors, killing sons, embezzling funds, bribery, oil extraction. Each war served to enrich a different faction, but in action, always winning the executives and investors of oil companies, grinning with their hair thinning, yet trying to live forever. Their greed paved deserts, forests, mountains, whatever stood in their way of conquest forever. Today, we fear the weather. Every year, it's more brutal. People die in wildfires. Others eat strudel. Climate chaos was contrived by a feudal mercantilist imperial agenda. Wars for profit turning rivers magenta are basically Wall Street trashing the rental. Each era's crimes compound those unresolved. Murder mysteries en masse unsolved. It's called history. Studying can solve our cycles of oppressions. We need to evolve. In 50 years, the CIA built an empire. The fears of a planet on a funeral pyre burned. Fossil fuels drive the temperature higher, melt the ice caps, dry the glaciers. Habitat destruction, species erasure, driven by the insatiable greed of a culture without vegetables. Meat for every meal is unsustainable, but that's what Wall Street puts on your table. Spinning lies, constructing false fables from the Pentagon Papers to the WikiLeaks tables. After Nixon went down, the lies continued later. Reagan's legacy was creating Al-Qaeda. The CIA trained them. A parade of corruption from Nicaragua to Panama, training rebels from Kabul to Managua, not just to wage rogue foreign policy, but ultimately to bring home a calamity. The CIA's crimes against humanity include not just everything else we've seen, but also mass incarceration. Here's the plan, see? Run drugs into LA and Miami. Arm traffickers. Spark a war in the streets. Kill police. Blame it on a crime wave. Then jail a generation of slaves. Each era's crimes compound those unresolved. Murder mysteries en masse unsolved. It's called history. Studying can solve our cycles of oppressions. We need to end them all.
You memorized that, did you?
There's a third verse that I frankly mess up half the time I try to recite it, so I saved that rather than stumble in the middle of it. Yeah, that's the first two.
Maybe we'll find it on your website, Shahid for Change, Shahid for F-O-R, change.us, and perhaps you will post that. And we go, yes, that's good. And then, you know, part of the dynamic is, you know, critique, that's good, and with a rhythm, and maybe in your future gatherings, call and response, but I also like to remind all of us, too, that we have a magic mirror, the secular critic and the poet, passionate politician and complex being that you are, you know, holds up mirror, which is important, going, oh, it's just fun. And then the trickster part of all of us coming alive and in yourself, you know, with a wave of the hand turns the mirror into a window. But look how it could be. Right? There we go. And then with another wave of the hand turns the window into a door. Let's go there, right? So I'm just, is that a fun part of your dynamic as well, going, here's what's terrible, here's the vision of that we're animating, and let's go do that. Is that part of your play?
I appreciate the terms you're giving me for it, in terms of the window, the door, and the mirror. I suppose for myself, I would have resonated with it just in terms of chronology, because the art for me came first. And so movement activism was an expression of my art, and I come to electoral politics with 20 years of experience as an advocate and an artist before that, basically watching our concerns fall on the deaf ears of careerists. So it was sort of like the art forced the culture for me, which then forced the politics. But I do like your presentation of how those different portals can swap in for one another. And I do, you know, very much aspire to be my whole self in this endeavor.
Right. Well, I think it's crucial, because the containment, the game show, story prison of much of what passes for news and the debates and all too, you know, constrained even Bernie, who was pretty good at, you know, here's the mirror, here's the window, let's go, and here's the door, we're gonna do this, and he would often just stay with mirror, right? Because it's like, oh, and I think that, yeah, you know, I love what you just said, that the art came first, and that might really be, you know, a kind of evolutionary, it does, the vision. you know, the vision magnetizes the possibilities. So that's great. And then this whole realm, yeah, because there are people everywhere, and I'm so glad to hear that the DC guerrilla poetry is there, because I'm in DC. I'm looking to connect. I'm going to go connect with your old poetry dynamic place. This idea of liberating cultural hijinks and this crucial hybrid, and so appreciative that you say that the story wants its soundtrack and its poetry and its rhythm and its kind of music. And it's true, we are not gathering now. We are in an experimental, you know, dynamic of caring for everybody in a forced, even the Republicans, right, a compelled introspection. There they were at CPAC. This virus has irony. There they were at CPAC and APEC going, oh, this coronavirus thing's a hoax. Oh, we're infected. Well, we're, yeah. And I forgot who it was. It was somebody, some major dingbat, who did say, ooh, it kind of makes you think about deep things and mortality. And it's like, yes, go do that. Oh, the enforced introspection. So we're not gathering now, but what do you have? What do you have laid out in the next part of your dynamic campaign?
For the campaign, yeah. So we have an office at 15th and Mission in 15th and Guerrero in the Mission, and it has been very much a hive through the primary cycle. We're sort of in the process of resetting the office for the next phase, and we're targeting a new set of voters. And over the last year and a half, we've been knocking on the doors, particularly of likely progressive voters, just in order to consolidate the progressive support we would need in order to get into the general election, which we've now done. And in the next phase, we expand the aperture. The doors we'll be knocking on in the next phase will be across the city rather than necessarily concentrated in our strongholds. We did really well in the primary phase in the Haight, in the Mission, in Vernal Heights. You know, we need to extend that success across the city. One of the places in particular that I aim to spend a lot of time is the Castro. The Castro tends to vote very much on the moderate side of San Francisco politics. And unfortunately, the Castro, by and large, supported in the primary earlier this month, a serial violator of human rights. And I see in Nancy Pelosi not only a figure who is willing to cover up the CIA torture scandal that continues to this day, for which no one's ever been held responsible, except for a single whistleblower who tried to stop it. I see Nancy Pelosi, you know, being unhelpful in the struggle for marriage equality when I and others, many others, were fighting in the courts and in state legislatures and the streets around the country. She did not show up for that fight. I see a pandemic starting, and it would be great if we had universal health care. This is exactly why we need it, so that everybody can get access to testing and whatever care they need. And the fact that we've treated hospitals and doctor's offices like yacht clubs instead of the fire department is senseless. And I see, you know, Nancy Pelosi, unfortunately, complicit in that as well. In this next phase, a lot of what we're going to be doing is educating San Francisco about her record. There's an impression I think a lot of people get of her based on media constructions driven by photo ops. And she's had a bunch of great photo ops. You know, she ripped up a president's speech that he frankly didn't have a right to give, but she decided to give him a campaign rally on national television. And while I think that was an incredibly bad decision, she got credit for ripping up his speech at the end. You know, other photo ops she's gotten credit for, angrily pointing across a table in the Oval Office or sternly putting on her shades as she's walking out of a meeting. You know, I am not, as a performer and an artist, I appreciate theater, and I understand that it is no substitute for governance, and it is certainly no substitute for resistance. And we need real resistance at a time like this, not a professional fundraiser whose idea of resistance is going along to get along. Just one example of that. On the very day that the House impeached the president, Nancy Pelosi gave President Trump a major policy victory by supporting his latest corporate trade agreement. And corporate trade agreements inherently undermine national sovereignty, environmental rights, and labor standards. And even if the latest corporate trade deal was marginally better than NAFTA 1.0, the fact that Nancy Pelosi is supporting the president's anything, including his historically large military budgets, including his concentration camps, including his foreign policy and the right-wing coups in Brazil and Venezuela and Bolivia in the last year alone. There have been so many arenas. I think it was 3 weeks ago that Pelosi welcomed Juan Guaido to Washington. And this is the beneficiary of a right-wing coup in a country in which, and this I'll share something here that it connects actually to the poem that I shared, and it also connects to one of the reasons why I'm running for this seat as an immigrant. I am particularly concerned about national security agencies that put their interests and the careers of their officials before the national security and the security of the United States. And that is the story of the CIA over the last 70 years. The agency has basically never done anything right. You know, they missed the intelligence suggesting the fall of the Berlin Wall. They trained al-Qaeda to fight the Soviets. We see how well that turned out. They ran drugs into LA and Miami. Nobody blames the CIA for mass incarceration, but the agency is all up in it. We wouldn't have mass incarceration if we had accountability for the CIA's previous round of human rights violations when they were murdering priests and raping nuns across Latin America. And there's never been a CIA program or human rights abuse that Nancy Pelosi has not voted for, tried to protect, and continued. And I think that for a city where the United Nations was founded, that being San Francisco, that's an unacceptable record in office. So, you know, you asked me what does the next phase of our campaign look like. The next phase of our campaign looks a lot like educating San Francisco about the untold story of Speaker Nancy Pelosi's unfortunate, sad, and unacceptable complicity with right-wing Republicans. Democratic abuses. A lot of these dimensions of authoritarianism are not just Republican or Democratic. That's, again, another reason forcing my hand here. I wish that Democrats stood up for civil rights. I wish that Democrats stood up for civil liberties. But, you know, it was at the end of last year, Nancy Pelosi extended the Patriot Act, of all things, to give Trump extended spying powers at the same time that she's showing up a year late for a limited simulacrum of accountability in an impeachment process that she constrained and ultimately lost, which we could have won. I just see this story of the speaker's rhetoric versus the reality as an object of education that we're going to need to spread from one end of the city to the other.
Right, and since you're dedicated and have been trained to speak across borders and everything, just for the fun of it, once at the first Gulf War, I remember being completely out. Well, I was invited to an artist's party, and I thought, well, of course, we're going to, you know, protest and change this. And everybody was mouthing platitudes. It was spooky. there is a lot of conditioning going. Well, at least there was no choice, and at least the bombs were smart. I'm like, oh! And I was like, da, 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 da. And people were very like, blah, 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 blah. And a wonderful friend said, you know, people never mind being asked, did you know the Kuwaitis were slant drilling oil into Iraq? Did you know? And I'm just sort of offering this because you have so much to put forth, you know, about Nancy Pelosi and the current state of things and the CIA. You know, did you know? Because I think it just guides people right in. No, because nobody minds being asked that, right? They go, no, I didn't know that. How interesting. And that's a great kind of litany.
You're talking about how to use cognitive dissonance, and it's a really helpful suggestion. I appreciate that.
Wait, what do you mean cognitive dissonance? What did you mean by your response there?
Well, so, you know, one of the challenges we confront in sharing with people this record that Nancy Pelosi has obscured with her photo ops is the resistance of people who voted for her for 30 years, who want to have been right, but they're being confronted by information that doesn't fit their mental impression. And so the dissonance of their long established allegiance to this supposedly, you know, stalwart lion of the left and the reality of her sad, again, unfortunate and ultimately unacceptable co-optation by the right, that creates a dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is sort of that a phenomenon when someone has an established impression and they're presented contrary information. And people often struggle to adapt their schema to accept new information. And so your idea of presenting these facts, which might be novel for many people, with a disarming preface, you know, that can't be objected to because it's simply asking, did you know? It's a clever way to disarm that cognitive dissonance. So that dissonance can be a real barrier to learning I have discovered and come
well,
to understand.
You've taken it on in a huge way, right? No, it's so effective. I mean, for all of us, you know, did you know, you can even spell it like a didgeridoo, D-I-D-J-A, did you know? If we don't, if we ask it neutrally, right, if we ask it snarkily, it's not going to do it. But did you know, and it looks good on a website, did you know, colon, dun, 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 because then people go, I didn't know that, you know. And then, see, I think this is part of our larger cultural dynamic, which is the dementors of doom, they do thrive on vitriol and conflict and polarity, right? They love that from in whatever direction. But see, did you know, and these other things, and you know, your animating of the, here's the desirable story, here's what sucks, here's the desirable story, here's what we're going to do, is the spiraling out of polarity. And, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is quite brilliant that way, even in her today, you know, addressing some people's ire that Elizabeth Warren's not backing anybody. And she just said, I want to see us coming together as a progressive win. I think that's important, where we draw strength from. I come from the lens of an organizer, and if someone doesn't do what you want, you don't blame them, you ask why. Curiosity. You don't demand the answer of that person, you reflect, and that reflection's where you can grow. Go, Alexandria. So there is that. And then in our last moment here, let me give it to you. What would you like as a, or anywhere you want to go, what would you like as a blessing for your dynamism? And what do you want to spiral out into the world now in 40 seconds?
I'm eager to spiral out into the world healing for our shared challenges and the collective projection of our resources and our energy and our mutual commitment to each other and our communities and the Republic to meet the needs of the future, to make sure that we can establish healthcare, housing, and food as human rights, to make sure that future generations can live a viable life. And in the meantime, to liberate San Francisco's voice in Washington so that human rights can once again be supported, not just by Barbara Lee in Oakland and not just by Ro Khanna down in San Jose, but by San Francisco's voice in Congress too.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much, Shahid Buttar, for being our guest. His website is shahidforchange.us. You can follow him on Twitter at shahidforchange. I'm Caroline Casey, thanking Antonio Ortez and Kirsten for being our wonderful board ops. And you can join us next week, coyotenetworknews.com. And may we all spiral out irresistible invitations to sane reverence. There we go. That's what we're up to. Thank you, team. Woof, woof, woof.